Once again, good morning. It's my privilege to welcome all of you to this year's National Convention of the Federalist Society. As in years past, the next several days will be a great opportunity to visit with old friends and to make some new ones. And in the Society's long-standing tradition of more than 35 years, to witness all sorts of thoughtful discussion and spirited debates about the current state of our legal culture. Now, this year, we decided to do something a little different, build the theme of the convention around originalism. Now, before you head for the back doors for another cup of coffee, let me offer two reasons why this evergreen subject is worth exploring here and now and again. First, hard as it may seem to believe, it's been almost 4 years since the most prominent champion of originalism, Antonin Scalia, passed away unexpectedly. Since then, there has been ample opportunity for many to feign the mantle of originalism. It's very fashionable these days to talk a high game in terms of embracing originalism, but anyone who followed Justice Scalia's lifelong refinement and defense of this doctrine knows that this is tough and tricky work. Simply saying you're an originalist doesn't make it so, and this convention's sessions will hopefully define the area more precisely. The second point I would make is that the broader public needs to understand why some stand up for originalism. Justice Scalia always believed it's because originalism's preservation of the structural Constitution is the best means of protecting the individual worth and dignity of every human person, which are at greatest risk when structural limitations on government powers are not respected and enforced. And I suspect there will be some discussion of this as well over the next couple of days. But before we embark on the panel discussion that addresses the specifics of originalism, we're going to open the conversation with remarks by someone who has long been an adherent of the originalist enterprise, going all the way back to his days as an active member of the Harvard Law School Federalist Society. Today, he's putting originalism in action as Florida's 46th governor, just recently appointing two justices to the Florida Supreme Court through a process that placed great emphasis on prospective candidates' fidelity to originalism and textualism and other aspects of the proper judicial role. He'll soon be at it again, because President Trump quickly stole his two appointments to the Florida Supreme Court, soon creating another search for committed Floridian originalists. Please join me in welcoming an individual with an extraordinary record of dedicated public as well as military service, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida.
Thank you. Thanks, Leonard. Thank you, guys. Thanks so much. Great to be with you. I get to come back in Washington, D.C., and I'm a recovering congressman, and so people will ask me, are you happy to be out of D.C.? And I say, is the Pope Catholic? Of course I'm happy to be out of D.C., and my swamp is warmer right now than your swamp is. It's about 75 degrees in Palm Beach, but it's good to be here. One of the reasons I ran for governor is because we had three pending vacancies because of age restrictions on our state Supreme Court. There had been a lot of, I think, positive things that had happened in Florida with respect to limited government, school choice, all these things. But one of the thorns in the side had been you still had an activist majority on the state Supreme Court who would rewrite laws, rewrite the Constitution, and basically showed very little respect for the political branches. And that was something that I think was bad for the constitutional system in Florida. I think it was also bad for some of the things we were trying to do in terms of economic growth, because you really didn't have a lot of certainty the legislature could pass reforms and they'd be uprooted pretty quickly. So we had a 7-member court, 4-justice majority, but 3 of those 4 were effectively termed out And so I came in and was able to do actually three appointments within my first few weeks of office. Now in Florida, the way this works is not like it is with federal judicial confirmations. We use what's called a judicial nominating commission. And so this is actually, I think, still during the gubernatorial election where they opened applications because they knew there these three vacancies would be there. So people could apply, the commission goes through it. I think they interview everybody that applies, and then they do whittle it down to a certified list. So they had a certified list that was done sometime in December during the gubernatorial transition, give it to me. And all you do in Florida at that point is just pick the names. And they're on the court, sign their documents, and they're on. There's no Senate confirmation, no anything beyond that. And so this was something that I took very seriously. So we had all 11 people came down to Florida. I had a group of people that I trusted. Leonard was one of them. And I wasn't involved at this point. And they just interviewed everyone, gave me an assessment, and then I personally interviewed all 11 one-on-one. And then determined, so this is sometime probably in like mid-December. And then at that point, I figured, okay, you know, I think I have my three people. But I didn't tell anyone who I picked because I knew it would leak. And it was a situation where if I were to announce it before I took office, you know, we were just coming off the Kavanaugh thing. I didn't want them to be pinatas and just get attacked or whatever. Once I was in, I could sign it. They're on the court. And that's just kind of the way it was. So I didn't tell anyone because I didn't want it to leak. And my wife even told me, she said, just don't tell me. She's like, I don't want to know what it is. I'm like, okay. And so... So we had it. But you know, you're going on, you're doing whatever you need to do to put people at the head of agencies, all these other things, have an agenda, come out of the gate very quickly. So there's a whole bunch of other stuff happening. So we end up going in. I'm inaugurated January 8th. You go, you take an oath, you give the speech, whatever, and then you have an inaugural ball. Well, we did all this stuff. Actually, my son at the time, we baptized him in the governor's mansion right after the swearing in, which was special. So my wife's getting ready for the inaugural ball. I am just kind of sitting in the mansion wondering, like, you know, how did I get here type of deal. But then it dawned on me that the next morning, I was supposed to announce my first Supreme Court pick, but I still had not told anybody who I was going to pick, including the nominee herself. And I think she's here, but Justice Lagoa, who, as Leonard mentioned, was one of the justices from our Supreme Court who's gotten tapped to be on the 11th Circuit and will be confirmed, I think, by the full Senate very quickly. But so I called Barbara like 5:30 the day before and said, look, if you can show up in Miami at 10 a.m. tomorrow, I'll put you on the Supreme Court. And she did. And she gave a great speech, but she was up late because I did not give her a lot of lead time on that one. So we ended up doing it, and then we put two other great justices on the court, and one of which, Robert Luck, is also nominated for the 11th Circuit. So they will have been on the Supreme Court less than a year, about 11 months, and then they will go up to the 11th Circuit, which is well-deserved, and I think those circuit courts are very, very important. So this was important for Florida. I think that we are on a good path, but I think that it was, obviously I took it seriously, but you had a lot of people working through Florida for a long time to develop, a really good bench of legal talent. I think we've got a lot of great people, and so as good as Barbara and Bobby Luck have been, I don't know if I'll quite get to that level, but we'll get pretty close because we got a lot of really good people to choose from. So within 13 months, most likely, because our process now for these remaining two will probably go to February. I will have made 5 appointments in 13 months. And to put that in perspective, two of my predecessors, Jeb Bush and Rick Scott, served a combined 16 years, and they made a combined 3 appointments in 16 years. So sometimes these things just happen. So I think it's neat. And I also, obviously here in Washington, one of the great success stories of the Trump administration has been their federal judicial appointments. You have two, of course, Supreme Court justices and a really fast clip of confirming circuit courts of appeals judges, which many of you know is sometimes just as important given the small caseload of the Supreme Court. And I think that's a great accomplishment for the president. I think senators like, you know, McConnell and Grassley and Lindsey Graham deserve a lot of credit for that. And I think there's been an emphasis on, you know, finding judges who feel, you know, that originalism and textualist approach is the right way to do it. The reason why I think that's the right way to do it is because you have to have some objective measure to go by. It can't just be flying off the seat of your pants, philosophizing and imposing whatever idiosyncratic views you have on society under the guise of constitutional interpretation. So originalism provides a mechanism to cabin judicial discretion, which I think is very, very important. And one of the frustrations I had in the Congress was, yeah, I think the founders were pretty clear about how the constitutional system was arranged and would operate. I mean, they viewed, you know, you had three separate branches. You know, one branch was not necessarily subordinate to the other. So when they say that they were equal, in that sense, you know, they were. But they certainly were not equal in terms of the powers that were assigned to the branches. I mean, there was qualitative and quantitative differences between the branches. Clearly, they believe, Madison said, the legislative authority predominates in a Republican system of government. If you look at the powers assigned in Article 1 of the Constitution, I mean, the power of the purse, so the executive can do what they want. You take away the money, the executive can't do it. So the Congress had robust powers, and I think the founders viewed the Congress as the focal point in constitutional government. They thought the executive, you know, would have an important role, but that would really depend on the exigencies. I mean, obviously, if you're engaging in any type of military conflict, president's commander-in-chief and foreign affairs, president had a very, very important role. But ultimately, even though the president could veto acts, the legislature could check that veto by overriding the veto. And so the president was important, but they also had just rebelled against the king, and so they did not envision the executive as it is today with the massive bureaucracy. And then, of course, they thought the courts were important, but as Hamilton said, by far the weakest of the three branches, because it could exercise neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and ultimately depends on the executive to enforce its judgments. And so that was, I think, kind of their view. So the court would play a role, but it would not be the dominant role in the constitutional system. Well, I think today, as we looked and having served in the Congress, to me, Congress is by far the weakest of the three branches. I mean, if you look, its most robust power, the power of the purse, it effectively has just put on autopilot. A lot of the spending is just automatic anyways, and then the rest they use continuing resolutions to just basically perpetuate government and perpetuate the status quo. Very rarely are they actually using the power of the purse to discipline the executive branch, to rein in any type of executive overreach, and that is true regardless of who's in, which party or the other has been in. And so you have a really neutered, I think, legislative branch. I mean, really, I did more in 1 week as governor than I did in 6 years as I mean, and I was active. I mean, I worked hard. They don't use the authority they have in an effective way, and I think that the constitutional system, you know, is discombobulated as a result. Of course, the executive branch, when you look at what the president's able to do, some of that is just because different circumstances. We're more involved internationally than we were when the founders envisioned the Constitution, so there's a huge power there. But also the bureaucracy. I mean, most of the people that would come to see me when I was in Congress that had a problem with something with the federal government did not have a problem with anything we were actually passing in Congress. It was the agencies that were doing this or doing that. And so most of the lawmaking was really being done by the executive branch agencies. And so you've had a massive bureaucracy grow, and you have the executive function really exercising both legislative and, in some cases, judicial powers, which is obviously not something the founders would have wanted to do. And then you have the court, which, you know, in some respects, in some instances, I think, sees itself as being almost superior to the other branches and superior to the Constitution itself even, and has gotten involved in a whole host of different things that I think they probably had no jurisdiction to deal with at the beginning. But certainly the court has more of an impact than the Congress does day in and day out, even only accepting 80 cases a year. So that's kind of the system. And so it just caused me to reflect, you know, I think it's great that you have two Supreme Court justices here and all these circuit judges, but the fact that that is viewed as a major achievement, to me, suggests that the courts are exercising too much power in the first place. You go back and look at... You go back and look, like, at some of the past... I think Joseph Story, when Madison put him... nominated, I think he was confirmed within 5 days. You look at Stephen Field during the Civil War, he's a Democrat from California. Lincoln nominates him within a week, he's confirmed. Robert Jackson, right before World War II, FDR. And the court had started to get more active then, but still, I think he was confirmed in like 3 weeks. And so the fact that now we have, you know, all these titanic struggles about who sits on that, shows that the court is playing too big a role in our society. And there's some that say, well, you know, if we just get enough originalists on the court, then on the Supreme Court and the lower courts, that everything can kind of be made right and everything will be good. And I think, look, that would be beneficial, don't get me wrong, but I have to think back to Federalist 51. The whole premise of the system is you're not going to have the right people in the positions of power. That's why they designed the system the way they did, because they said if angels were to govern men, then no government would be necessary. And that is something that I think the founders believed at their core, that you had to have a system of checks and balances to keep each branch in line. And so for me, I want to see great judges. I think that's important. But I also want to see a system that works even when you have the wrong people in positions of power. And I think that we see some of the problems here. So I think judicial power is too robust right now. And I think the checks upon it are just simply inadequate. I think part of it is, you know, you can go back to the original design and see the checks on it, but then also the checks that are there really aren't used by the Congress anymore. And I think that one of the areas, and I'm sure you guys will discuss it at this conference, that brings this into focus is the use of these nationwide injunctions by one district judge. And so, you know, you have a national policy that's put in place, you know, by the executive branch, and then you have a flurry of lawsuits. So the executive wins in Boston, they win in New York, they win in Atlanta, they win in Minneapolis, they win in Las Vegas, but they lose in San Francisco. And so guess what? You win all those other ones, you lose in San Francisco, so the whole policy is put on ice. And we can sit there and say, like, oh yeah, these are just rogue district judges, they're part of the legal resistance, they're resisting Trump and all this stuff, and the Supreme Court will correct it, they have corrected a lot of these, and that is true, but what happens in the meantime? I mean, you got like 2 years that goes by where the policy is frozen just because you have one district judge that puts it on hold. To me, the one district judge issuing a nationwide injunction is not a legitimate use of judicial power. I mean, I'd like to see the U.S. Supreme Court rein that in, but I think there's things that probably Congress can do to rein it in. But that's just the thing. I think that the checks that are there, jurisdiction stripping, hasn't really proven to be that effective. Hamilton said, look, if a judge gets off the rails, he'll get impeached and removed from office. That hasn't really proven to be successful. I think in the Federalist, Hamilton suggests that if the judges get off the rails, then the executive will just, you know, let that decision go, but not really enforce it. But again, that's not something that is there. But I think that we're in a situation now where whatever institutional counteraction that the founders envision, that's just simply overwhelmed by the partisan interests that you see now in national politics. And so there may be something that's detrimental to your branch, but if that's more for your team and the partisanship is going in a good direction, then you're willing to see your own branch diminished in order to achieve the more partisan ends. And that goes with both sides. But I think the founders believe that where you sit was where you were supposed to stand when it comes to institutional power. But that's not really where it is. You do not see a robust defense across party lines of Congress's prerogatives, of the executive's prerogatives, you know, when those prerogatives are challenged. It's all situational. So the Congress really cares about its lawmaking authority when President Obama is doing some of these more legislative in nature executive orders. But then the same people that didn't care about that, they now care about it when the president's different and vice versa. So that to me is just not going to be something that's going to be an effective check. And so I think back, Lincoln, he had to confront the Dred Scott decision, which is obviously one of the worst cases that the Supreme Court has ever decided. And in his inaugural address, he said that, if you have the whole policy of the whole country decided by the Supreme Court based on one lawsuit between two parties, then the people are no longer their own rulers, and they're essentially turning over their authority to this eminent tribunal. And he proceeded to work with Congress. The Dred Scott said you cannot prohibit slavery in the territories. Well, the whole Republican Party was founded to prohibit slavery in the territories. So that's kind of like, saying that the Republican Party itself was unconstitutional at the time. And so Lincoln, they went ahead and they did ban it in 1862. The Congress did that in spite of Dred Scott. But Lincoln had to wrestle with this before he was president because he says, okay, if a decision's made, if we just don't respond, honor any decision, then you just have lawlessness. So he always honored it with respect to the parties in the case in Dred Scott. But he said, I'm just not ready to say that this settles our policy for the whole country infinitum. And he went through different factors in his judgment. He believed that a unanimous decision was carried more weight than a split decision. I think Dred Scott was 7-2. He said if the decision broke down on party lines, that he'd be less likely to say that that settled policy for the whole country. And then he said if it was a novel interpretation that was at odds with how previous branches had viewed it. So, for example, Congress, had enacted a lot of legislation that presumed they had the authority to regulate slavery in the territories, that would be something that he would consider. But, I mean, this was something that he really, really struggled with. And I don't suggest that there's easy answers to it. But what I would like to suggest is that, in our system of government, it's the Constitution that is supreme. It's not the judiciary that is supreme. Courts are part of the constitutional system, but they do not hover above the constitutional system. And the more serious that other political actors take their role, I think the stronger our constitutional system will be. So the point I'll make is originalism, I think, is important to figure out how you do constitutional interpretation, how you apply legislative text. But I think also, I consider originalism to be, the structural constitution and how different people who are actually in these branches are going to use their authority to preserve their own institutional interests. And if we say originalism is only about interpreting a statute or only about interpreting the Bill of Rights, then I think we're leaving so much on the table. And ultimately, even though an originalist judge, I think, would be more respectful of the separation of powers than a non-originalist judge, we're kind of tacitly still saying, that the judiciary is superior to the other branches of government. I don't think that's what the Founding Fathers envisioned, and I don't think that that's what's the best for the country. So members of Congress, if I was still there, I would tell them to take their obligations to protect their institution seriously. And the same thing with the executive branch. True originalism, means all these branches checking and balancing each other just as the Founding Fathers intended. Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate it. Yep. Sure.